The Energy Gang is brought to you by Bloom Energy. Bloom Energy is transforming the way businesses and communities take charge of their energy supply through resilient, predictable, and zero-carbon solutions. Bloom's on-site energy platform provides unparalleled control for those looking to secure clean, reliable 24/7 power that scales to meet critical business needs. Today's energy challenges are unprecedented and widespread. Bloom's platform eliminates outage and price risk while accelerating us all toward a zero-carbon future. Visit bloomenergy.com/theenergygang and take charge today. The Energy Gang is brought to you by Hitachi Energy. How is the grid evolving and changing? What does it mean for your business, your energy needs, your customers? Whatever your goals, look to Hitachi Energy for the right technologies to help unlock new revenue streams, maximize renewable integration, and lower carbon emissions. Visit hitachienergy.com/offerings/solutions/grid-edge-solutions. This is The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-changing world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks. Welcome to the show. This week, the COP26 circus has left town from Glasgow and will be doing the clearing up. What were the successes, what were the failures in the 2 weeks of talks? And have they really made a difference in terms of bending the curve of global greenhouse gas emissions? Plus, the climate provisions in the US infrastructure bill just being signed into law by President Biden are focused around the grid, electric vehicle charging and early stage technologies such as hydrogen. While we wait for the Build Back Better Act to be passed, and who knows when that might happen, this is the only real action on energy legislation so far from Congress. How much of an impact will it have? Something else the Biden administration has been doing this month is launching an Earthshot for negative emissions technologies. It's a cliche to say there are no silver bullets for tackling climate change, but could negative emissions actually be that silver bullet? To discuss these questions, I'm joined as usual by Melissa Lott, who's Director of Research at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. Hello, Melissa. How are you?
Doing great, Ed. It's been a busy couple of weeks, I'll say.
Indeed it has. Indeed it has. Glad you're surviving, though. And also this week, we're joined by Amy Myers Jaffe, who's Managing Director of the Climate Policy Lab at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Hello, Amy. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Before we get started, Amy, maybe you could just talk a little bit about yourself, tell listeners where you came from, how you got into energy, and what you're doing at the Climate Policy Lab. It's an intriguing sounding concept, a lab for climate policy. What do you actually do there?
Well, let me just say that my first interaction with energy was sitting in the car with my father in line for gasoline back in the 70s, and I've never left the subject. Did a term paper on it in high school, was an energy journalist for many years, and then I became a professor teaching energy policy and sustainability at several business schools and universities, now at Tufts. And our climate policy lab is really designed to help governments and also private sector. So that's kind of what I do now in my day job. And I'm looking forward to discussing our range of activities today in the energy world.
Right. So really the perfect background then for this conversation we're about to have about COP26. So of course, the conference ended over the weekend. The gavel finally went down at 11:28 on Saturday night, which meant that it finished about 30 hours late. Of course, it's absolutely part of the course for COPs to run late. In fact, this was only the sixth longest COP, this one. I actually took part in the COP myself. I spoke at a fringe event, but I did it from my bedroom over Zoom. I didn't take my private jet. I didn't even fly commercial, which I feel pretty good about that, actually. I feel that was the right way to do it. Now, Melissa and Amy, I know neither of you went, but I think your institutions both were very well represented there. Can you talk a bit about what happened, why you think it's worth sending a team to COP, and what do you actually get out of being there kind of physically on the ground in Glasgow, as opposed to, as I say, doing what I did and just zooming in? Melissa, what did Columbia do in terms of engagement, involvement with COP?
Yes, I know Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy, where I am in partnership with our climate school, did a series of events over there in Glasgow, and we had a small team that flew over for those events, including, I believe it was three of our co-founding deans of the new climate school. There are four, and three of the four were able to make it over. And I mean, at a high level, a lot of the engagements and the value in engaging in person via Zoom, I think many, many more of us are aware of the value of in-person meetings, perhaps, than we were 18 months ago as we pushed everything over to Zoom. And I know a number of the conversations that folks were able to have in person, we hosted an event with former President Obama where we brought in different youth activists and youth who are pushing forward on climate mitigation, adaptation, and what we need to be doing in the short term. And those conversations were productive and engaging and interesting, and it was certainly worth for a bunch of the announcements and events having them in person. But we did keep the team small. It was only a few people going over. And I think a lot of people did that, in this COP in particular, with everything going on with COVID.
Amy, Tufts also had quite a few people there, right?
We did, and I tell people I've had a large career of having my picture taken with people from the blah, blah, blah. So no need for me to go and do more of that. But we have a younger generation of scholars, lawyers, and others that work with us as students at Climate Policy Lab. So our delegation was important to send those students to meet with others who are younger generation from different countries. We have one of our PhD students who already has a law degree from India went and presented our work on the best path forward for decarbonization in India in the Indian Pavilion. And I have great pictures of some of our Chinese students with the delegation, the climate delegation from China. But the idea was we want to have this younger generation meet their cohort and hopefully do a better job than we, the older generation. And let me just say, this generation has a tendency to really focus on, you know, first principles approach, like tell me what the problem is, and then I'll come up with a creative way of making that solution, as opposed to saying, well, we've already always done it this way, and so we need to tweak what we've already done. And that's kind of why I feel optimistic sending this younger set of analysts and scholars and modelers to meet each other. Maybe they do a better job than those of us who've been looking at it a long time.
And certainly, as Melissa was saying, you do get a completely different kind of communication, don't you? I was saying I took part via Zoom, which was fine, but I kind of spoke and I took a few questions and that was it. And then I clicked off the link and I was back in my bedroom again. In terms of those kind of informal links that you can build with people by being there, and just in terms of the way that communication works in terms of picking up body language and nonverbal signals and just sort of building trust and understanding between people. A lot of the time, I think you do have to be there in person. You do have to be meeting face to face, don't you?
Well, my experience has been, you know, doing public speaking and speaking in front of an audience that, you know, you get the vibe right away if you're going down a non-constructive path. Or you can see the audience get extremely excited if you're telling them something that makes them feel optimistic. I mean, there's nothing beats that. As well as we've done over Zoom, it's just much harder, I think, to speak over Zoom.
So let's talk about the substance of what was decided at COP26. You've probably seen that footage of Alok Sharma, the British politician who was president of the COP, announcing the conclusions at the end, really fighting back tears. He was so disappointed in the way things had turned out. It was obviously quite a downbeat end, and I think helped give people the impression that the talks have been a failure. And certainly you'll hear people saying talks were a failure, hasn't achieved anything really substantive, hasn't achieved what it should have achieved. But on the other hand, if you read the Glasgow Climate Pact, which was the agreement that came out of it at the end, the written text, and if you talk to people who were involved in the talks, who've been watching them, I've been talking to my colleagues at Wood Mackenzie and to others over the past day or so about what was achieved, actually it does look like there was some real progress. And it's really unfair, actually, to see the talks as a complete failure. So, Amy, what's your thought on that? I mean, how do you read it? A success or a failure?
Well, I think you have to balance, you know, from the point of view of the urgency and we need immediate action, you know, definite failure. But I tend to be optimistic, so I try to focus on the positive. I thought that paradigm that was set up with South Africa, that the countries, United States, UK, France, Germany, would provide financing to really get South Africa to retire a pretty big chunk of its coal, was a pretty interesting paradigm. You know, one wonders, you know, if India had put a number out on the table, well, we'd have got a better deal with India. So I thought that was an interesting achievement. And South Africa, obviously, you know, devil in the details. I think one of the things that makes people concerned is even these things that were pledged, like the methane pledge and the deforestation pledges that look pretty substantive. You know, the question is, will countries really do what they're saying? Will they really follow through? That's going to be a big thing. But the other thing I think that's really important is that we're all talking about 1.5 degrees. At Paris, there was this thing about maybe we should be a little more ambitious and move away from 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees. Now I think you really have this focus on 1.5 degrees. you having this increased recognition that we need to do net zero and not carbon neutrality. So we're kind of rejecting the idea that we're all going to work with pollution credits, but actually we're talking seriously about what is the transparency of verification? How do we organize removal of carbon from the atmosphere? So I think the ball's moved in the right direction. And now the question is, you know, what can we do to really get momentum behind the movement we've already had?
I see your point. But on the other hand, don't you think there's a bit of a sense of unreality about the debate? That, as you say, there's a lot of talk about sticking to that kind of the stretch goal of the Paris Agreement, which is limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees C. People say that's not dead as an ideal, as an objective. That's still what the world could and should be aiming for. But actually, if you look at the pledges that countries have made in terms of cutting emissions, even on the basis of those announced pledges, we're not on course to limit global warming to 1.5°C. And then, as you say, there's the huge question of whether countries will actually live up to the commitments they've made. And in practice, what may well happen is we're going to be even further away from 1.5 degrees because of countries failing to achieve their goals. So just still feels to me like there's some way to go before policy really acknowledges the reality of what needs to be done to get to 1.5 degrees. Maybe that's fine, actually. And maybe there's an argument to be had about, is 1.5 the right goal? And, you know, what are the costs of driving down emissions to net zero so quickly that we can stay on that 1.5 degree trajectory? One thing that's very clear is we're not on it now.
Well, that's true. And absolutely, you know, all the negotiators had trouble really pushing countries into their 2030 milestones. Because without the right 2030 milestone, you know, any promise you're making for 2050, you know, it's got a lot of air in it. And indeed, you know, for those listeners who've been reading the press and they don't understand, you know, how is the International Energy Agency saying these national pledges are going to lead us to 1.8 degrees warming by 2100, but then you read other reports that say 2.5 degrees from a, you know, group of scientists that published an analysis in Science magazine. You know, part of that has to do with, what are you assuming about how much extra ambition countries are going to be willing to do in the next 3 years or 5 years? And I think that it's important to understand that countries need to do more, that this was disappointing in the sense that we need broader commitments from countries. And so we are more ambitious than Paris, but still not good enough. And I think what we do about the still not good enough, whether that's through technology efforts, you know, we have a lot of countries putting stimulus through technology R&D. We've got a lot of innovative leaders coming out with really, you know, interesting technologies. As you know, I wrote a book about digital, and there's just a lot of potential in digital to bring different kinds of solutions that would both build resilience to weather events at the same time as delivering lower emissions. But really, you know, we have these laggards, these countries that really try to block all efforts. And I see personally the high energy prices we're seeing in Europe with natural gas because of the Russian, you know, issue about supply, non-supply, and even, you know, the OPEC Plus agreement not to put enough oil in the market and have prices rising. Those are attempts by countries to try to derail decarbonization because it's not in their interests. But it's not in their, like, short-term this year financial interests. But if you look at melting permafrost and its unbelievably adverse effect on Russia, and if you think about heat and its challenge for human survival, and you think about the Persian Gulf, like, these governments are not doing what's best for their own populations.
So, Melissa, what do you think? What's your big takeaway, success or failure?
Overall, for me, COP was a success, but I have a filter that maybe is different from a lot of people who are listening to this, and certainly than a lot of people I work with and that I speak to. I mean, overall, I wasn't expecting the outcome of COP to be binding global policies reducing emissions. I mean, that wasn't on the table in the first point. That's not how COP is designed. What I was expecting was for COP to be a forcing function and for countries to come to Glasgow and to make some form of an agreement. And they did that. And overall, if I back up and I think about the whole optimistic view of this, the positive spin on it all. We were at something, was it 3.7 degrees-ish warming by 2100 pre-Paris. Now we're in the 2.4 to 2.7 band, let's say. And we may, and let's be clear about the IEA numbers, if we follow through on non-binding commitments, make them binding, make them reality, we may be heading below 2 degrees, maybe. This is a very different reality than a decade ago. And that's really exciting to me. It's definitely positive. And I think some of the announcements around methane, around a whole host of things that we can talk about here in a minute, Ed, were very encouraging. Is it enough? No, we haven't bent the curve yet. COP is just about getting people together to make these agreements to move forward with. At the end of the day, it's now about implementation and turning ambition into reality. And until ambition becomes reality, at the end of the day, I'm an engineer. I need to see the numbers. And the climate doesn't care about ambition. The climate cares about how much greenhouse gases we're putting into it. And so I think COP was a success, but is it the full picture? Are we done now? Absolutely not.
So what do you think also of the point that Amy just made, which sounds quite a pessimistic point in terms of the progress of international climate action? If you look around the world, there are a lot of countries that are very heavily reliant on fossil fuels for revenue, jobs, export, foreign currency earnings, and so on. It is not in the interests of those countries, certainly not in their short-term financial interest, to accelerate the energy transition to move away from fossil fuels. And if you're working through a UN process that has to work by consensus, has to get everybody on board, then that's going to be a real problem in terms of accelerating the energy transition, moving decisively away from fossil fuels. Is that a real issue, do you think? Is that something that is, at the end of the day, always going to obstruct progress as we try to move away from fossil fuels?
We're all aware that we're not working with a blank slate here, right? We have a lot of infrastructure that was put in place that has brought a lot of benefit over the past many decades, and now we're looking to do something different. Instead of just adding new fuels to the mix, we're looking at replacing them. We're looking at phasing certain fuels out, and that is a big shift. And it will not just affect supply companies and bottom lines. It will affect households and individuals who work in these communities who have built careers around, you know, pulling coal out of the ground, extracting oil and gas from the ground. I mean, these are real people in addition to real companies. And certainly, this is just one of the many tensions that we're seeing playing out in these discussions. How do we transition? How do we not leave entire communities and parts of the world behind as we do something that is necessary if we want to protect the public health of people around the world? So that is one tension. One thing I'd say is that sometimes we focus, I think, a bit over much on the supply side. Now, absolutely excited about the methane announcements that are coming out and reducing cumulative emissions from the production of the fuels that we still use today and will still use for a while. But overall, I think some of the most interesting stuff that is going on is actually on the demand side. And some of our focus should also be focused on the demand side, because as long as we are requesting and requiring fossil fuels to move us around and keep economies running, there's going to be this big tension there because we need someone to supply it somewhere to keep us moving down. So we need to simultaneously be focusing on supply side, but also demand side, because that demand pull is extremely powerful.
I mean, the real thing is, you know, technology, technology, technology. You know, there might have been somebody who lost their job making analog telephones and wires. But in the end, you know, the smartphone was a superior technology. As its cost came down, the transition to broadband and other things, you know, was a pretty fast transition. So the question here is, we have a lot of innovation coming down the road. You know, we have governments pushing that innovation, developing hubs and systems to get things out into the marketplace faster, get past the so-called valley of death. And the level of promise, it's like every day, you know, it was batteries, now, you know, but batteries can't handle seasonal. Now, all of a sudden, we're talking about batteries that can handle seasonal, you know, new models of electric cars that meet all different kinds of needs, trucks, you know, couldn't do electric trucks. Now we're doing electric trucks. So I do think that we're really pushing the envelope. Some of these very countries that are worried about the transition and what it's going to mean for them are themselves investing in these new innovative technologies and might wind up being some of the big players, say, for example, in hydrogen. And so we really have this sort of disconnect between, oh, I'm worried about today and the problems of today versus I am actually investing in these systems we need to move to. And so the real challenge, I think, for diplomacy is, how do I get everybody on the same page that acceleration is actually good? You know, how am I going to handle that? And that's why the South Africa deal was the most important because the funds that are being given to South Africa are not just for paying for renewable energy. They're for helping communities that need to transition. So some of that money is going to people and not just to things and property. And that's really, I think, the pivotal part.
I think this is a great point here that you're bringing up, Amy, which is about what we will learn from something like that investment from South Africa and how that could potentially give us a playbook for how this works in other parts of the world. We'll certainly learn from it. The other point I'll just pick up on really quick, and I'm looking at your book right now, Energy's Digital Future. I know. I was flipping through it earlier, not just in preparation for this podcast. I think it's a really important point to think about, you know, what has actually driven emissions reductions to date? And this brings up an interesting question for the role of government in spurring innovation around what we need to innovate around and what we need to do to actually get to these net zero targets. Because one thing that I think is clear to the points we talked about earlier and to coming out of Glasgow is just how much more quickly we are moving down the road than we may have expected pre-Paris, going into the Paris Agreement. Are we there yet? Are we on the path we need to be to reach net zero and stay, you know, well below 2 degrees? No, but we're a lot further along than many of us thought we would. So what do we do to be able to address tail emissions, you know, the last 10%, the last 20%, and to help these countries that would have gone down a path that was very carbon intensive, that we're now trying to help be on a path that is not as carbon intensive, because that will matter a heck of a lot in terms of cumulative emissions going forward. So it's a great point.
So let's have a look at some other specific announcements that we got during COP26. We had Emily Chazen of Generate Capital on the show last time, and she picked out three things in particular that she was going to be watching for to judge success or failure. She talked about the agreement on cutting methane emissions, finalizing the rules for international emissions trading, and making sure developing countries get the $100 billion a year in climate finance that they were promised back in Paris and still has not yet been achieved. My feeling is, if you're looking at those three things, you probably score 2 out of 3 as a success. I think there was definite progress on methane emissions. There was definite progress on the rules for international emissions trading. On the finance, that's still clearly a problem, a sticking point, but at least kind of talks continue. And as you say, maybe that South Africa deal, that's a really interesting example of how climate finance can work and can be developed in the future. What are your thoughts on those three things? Do you agree that that's kind of 2 out of 3 in terms of hits and misses there for COP26?
I'll say overall, my interpretation, I'm going to snag a quote from John Kerry. If it's a good negotiation, all the parties are uncomfortable. And this has been, I think, a good negotiation. I think that pretty much sums it up. There are parts where a number of us are uncomfortable in different ways. And I was struck, I'll focus on coal for a minute, and these commitments from major coal-using countries like Canada, Poland, South Korea, Ukraine, Indonesia, Vietnam. You know, the overall okay, is it phasing out or phasing down of coal? I found it really interesting to follow some of the comments from India's environment and climate minister, flagging that a lot of the negotiations and a lot of the discussions had really singled out coal, but kept oil and natural gas kind of, you know, behind or outside of the radar. They weren't really focused in on that. And I'll say that, you know, we singled out coal in our first Lancet paper, where we focused in on the effects of climate change on health and the mitigation options that were out there. And we said, look, there's no reason to continue using coal because, to Amy's point earlier, we have other options. So this isn't a choice between having basic access behind having electricity in your home and using coal. We actually have other options there. And some of the reasons we have other options is because of tons of investment that went into developing the technologies that we're able to use today. The cost declines in wind and solar and batteries being something we focus on quite a lot. I'd also flag that the willingness to focus in on this part of the energy sector, to me, also signals the importance of driving down costs of alternatives. So in coal, to the point it has made, we have alternatives. To some of the other fuels, it's a bit more complicated. I think about natural gas and how many parts of the economy it's used in, and oil and how dependent we are for producing so many of the fuels that we use in our economy that we don't have great drop-in replacements for. We need to be spending more time on actually phasing them out.
Actually, I think one of the things that maybe was understated was the fact that the United States and China did manage to get it together and have some positive joint statements, because there was a window there where maybe that didn't seem like it was going to be possible. So again, you know, kind of weak joint statements. So, you know, maybe a C minus, but A for effort, in the sense that both countries recognize how important this issue is and that it has to be global. And at least that opens the window for more ambition going forward and cooperation that could be deeper.
Absolutely agree. It's a really important point and something we haven't focused on yet. Just the fact that those conversations seem to have moved in such a more positive direction than they were very recently. The opening of doors and windows, that's really encouraging because at the end of the day, we need the globe to move if we're going to actually mitigate and adapt to what's going on with climate change. I think it's a great point, Amy.
So, as you say, the conversation continues and it's clear there is still an enormous amount of pressure on everyone to be continuing to ratchet up their ambition, to do more to curb emissions, to shift further away from fossil fuels, and to get closer to that trajectory that does actually meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. COP27 will be held in a year's time in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, which sounds pretty nice. I don't know, maybe I'll see you there. Although, on the other hand, quite possibly, I suspect I'll be back there on a virtual basis in Zoom again. But anyway, there will be, I'm sure, a lot to talk about when that comes around. And as you say, I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether this momentum continues. When you think about success or failure, I guess one of the crucial things I think about is just that question of, is there still momentum? Is the level of ambition still increasing? It's like riding a bike. If the world doesn't keep moving forward, if climate talks don't keep moving forward, then they'll fall over. And actually, at the moment, they are still moving forward. Do you agree?
I completely agree in the sense of, I've been speaking with so many of our colleagues at the Center on Global Energy Policy who used to be in, you know, negotiators in these rooms during these discussions. And the success is that it's forcing us as a global community. I mean, think how many news articles, how many conversations we've had have focused on COP. We have set aside time and space to have discussions around a really important issue and place pressure on the system to make increasingly ambitious commitments. That is a success. Now, is it enough? Well, it depends on the end goal. The end goals we set in Paris, not quite yet, but it has forced us to keep focus on this topic. And next year's COP is going to come around fast. There's going to be barely a pause in what's going on behind closed doors and in different rooms before going into the next discussions in Egypt.
Listen, I think what happens here is that the private sector gets the signal that governments are going to take action, that governments that you might have expected not to take action or make a pledge are doing that. And it means that the private sector has to take action. It means that they have to deliver the products that we're going to need to meet those targets. And it means that shareholders that have been quite active on the subject of climate change in the past year can build on this momentum to make more demands for companies to pivot.
The Energy Gang is brought to you by Bloom Energy. Bloom Energy is accelerating the hydrogen economy by partnering with industry leaders to produce clean, green hydrogen. Bloom's electrolyzer uses electricity and heat from a variety of clean energy sources, such as concentrated solar power, solar panels, and nuclear power, to generate green hydrogen at the scale needed to tackle today's urgent climate crisis. Bloom's pioneering solid oxide fuel cell platform leverages technology originally developed for Mars, and it's uniquely designed to decarbonize our world's hardest to abate sectors. Bloom's platform has the flexibility to be deployed as a distributed generator of electricity or as an electrolyzer to produce green hydrogen. Learn more at bloomenergy.com/theenergygang. The Energy Gang is brought to you by Hitachi Energy. The grid is evolving and changing every day, but the fundamentals haven't. Safe, reliable power is needed everywhere. No matter where you are, battery energy storage paired with advanced controls and software can improve resilience and efficiency. With grid-edge solutions from Hitachi Energy, you can integrate solar or wind to reach your sustainability goals while managing energy costs. It's all achievable with our innovative grid-edge solutions. Learn more at hitachienergy.com/offering/solutions/grid-edge-solutions. Now, the infrastructure bill. When President Biden was in Glasgow at the start of the COP26 conference, he was able to say, look, the US is back. We're participating in the global effort to fight climate change, not just in a formal way, because formally the US has rejoined Paris, but through legislation that's been making its way through Congress to support low carbon energy. There have been two key bills that have been debated in Congress. There's the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which has bipartisan support, and also the Build Back Better Act, which is most definitely not bipartisan. That seems to be opposed by every Republican in Congress, and many of its provisions, quite a lot of Democrats are skeptical about as well. That act, the Build Back Better Act, is still mired in infighting in Congress. Unclear what's going to happen to that, but the infrastructure bill has passed Congress and is being signed into law by President Biden as we speak, I think, this week. Now, this act, it's not primarily an energy or a climate bill. It includes a lot of money for roads and bridges, for water pipes, for rural broadband and so on. But it does have some very important energy-related provisions. There's money for the grid, for EV charging infrastructure. There are measures to make it easier to invest in new grid infrastructure. And there's also support for three key early-stage energy technologies: hydrogen, carbon capture, and advanced nuclear power. I want to get into talking about nuclear power and the rest of the infrastructure bill in a moment. But actually, before I do that, I feel like I should have a quick background check about where we all stand on nuclear power, which seems to be one of those issues that's very contentious. And often people who are kind of broadly in agreement on the need for an energy transition, the need to address climate change, can have very different views on nuclear power. So, well, maybe I'll come to my thoughts in a moment. But I mean, Amy, what do you think? Would you describe yourself as pro-nuclear?
Well, you know, I sat on a panel, Ed, a few years ago on cybersecurity for nuclear plants, and that was one of the most frightening things I've done in my career. So I've typically not been a fan of nuclear, but as I've learned more about some of the new advanced designs that we're looking at on a forward basis, some of the new advanced reactor designs that we're looking at and are being funded in the United States, for example, are looking at using as its fuel the very spent waste that causes the environmental community to be against nuclear in the first place. So if we could get to the point with some of these reactor designs, whether that's liquid thorium or the molten salt or fast reactors, these designs have more potential. And of course, DOE is really pushing this concept. If anybody hears the term integrated energy solutions, it sounds very vague. You don't really know what that is. But that is actually coupling nuclear with renewables with these new concept designs. And, you know, nuclear advocates, I'm not one, but I hear them, you know, talk about the fact that you're going to get this benefit of both being able to use the heat, which could be important for decarbonizing heavy industry. And of course, you have the electricity services that could be paired in such a way to backup renewables for resilience. And indeed, U.S. military, you know, micronuclear plant in Alaska. So at least on some level, someone's out there thinking strategically about what small plants that are modular and therefore you can keep the cost down, what that could mean.
What do you think, Melissa? Are you pro-nuclear? Would you pin that badge on yourself?
I think I'm going to take a page out of Amory Lovins's book, but not in the way you might think. So Amory Lovins talks about how I don't really care about the kilowatt hours. I want hot showers and cold beer. At a high level, I think I'm pro-decarbonization. And so I think about nuclear purely in the sense of, does it help us get to our goal or not? So within that, I mean, we know that the power sector and electrification are the backbone of the transition to reach net zero targets. Net zero targets that will protect the health of our communities. So that's a good thing. And if we want to ensure that we have that a reliable and affordable transition, the research and the analysis is really clear on the point that we need three buckets broadly of technologies in order to ensure a reliable electricity supply. So first, we want those variable renewables, wind and solar. Absolutely want them, want a lot more than we have in the system right now. We want energy storage. We want the batteries. We want the, you know, couple hours to 100 hours type of electricity storage, but also seasonal storage. Some of the points that Amy was bringing up around how do we move electricity from early spring to late summer. But third, we want to think about firm dispatchable power plants. And nuclear is an option that falls into that bucket, along with other potential technologies. So things like geothermal, natural gas with CCUS, hydrogen, synthetic methane, a whole host of technologies. So when I think about nuclear, it's a tool that might be able to help us get to our goal. Like with every other technology, it comes with trade-offs. So it's about weighing those trade-offs, and it's about different communities and different regions and different countries weighing the trade-offs and making a decision. But if we don't have anything in that firm dispatchable bucket, we see increasing costs and decreasing reliability, and that's not good for anyone. So we have to make some choices.
So let me play devil's advocate here for the, you know, clean energy renewables business. So what they would say if they were here with us, perhaps, well, listen, think about how much renewable energy you could deploy with that same $6 billion. And are we just dumping too much money down the nuclear bucket? And, you know, we have the example of the loan office with their $8 billion in, you know, money for that plant in Georgia. So there is this fear on nuclear, I think, that is just like a money pit. And, you know, how much energy do we really get compared if we deployed that same amount of funds in renewables?
I think something that's being highlighted with these types of concerns is actually just how ill-equipped our markets are right now in the power sector to achieve the goal we're talking about, which is a net zero future. We don't have clear-cut rules that encourage that and support the building out of the balance of technologies we need to do that in a reliable and affordable way. And so there's certainly a tension there, you know, not having having markets that were designed for what we wanted in the past and not necessarily what we want in the future if we are headed towards net zero.
And yeah, I agree with that. I mean, my position on nuclear power, I guess, to be wishy-washy and agree with both of you, is that I agree with Melissa's point about, as you say, clean, firm power is really important. And I also agree with Amy's point, which is that the cost is the single biggest argument against nuclear. The cost is has been horrendous and projects have run way over budget. However, my devil's advocate argument in favor of the nuclear industry is to say these things are very long-lived. You build a big nuclear plant, it might last for 80 or 100 years. On that kind of scale, on a century-long time scale, actually a 10-year delay and $10 billion or $20 billion cost overrun starts to kind of dwindle into insignificance in the rearview mirror. And if we just bit the bullet and said, we're going to build these plants, whatever the expense, we're just going to make sure it happens, quite possible, I think, people in 50 years from now are going to be really grateful and say, we're actually very glad you did that, because these plants are still working. They've still got another 30 or 50 years of working life ahead of them. And they're churning out a lot of clean, firm power that is something we really need. I can see, Melissa, you're pulling a face. You don't agree.
I just can't get around the idea of someone selling you something and saying, here, this is going to cost you a dollar. And then, oh, just kidding, after you've already received it, but like it's going to be $3. Like that doesn't work for me. What is much more in line with what I think we could see in the future is actually saying, let's understand why we've seen these cost overruns, understand why we haven't done a great job of estimating what it will realistically cost to build this out, make realistic cost determinations, and then figure out how to make those into reality. And so where are we going wrong? Why did we think it was a dollar and then it was three? Why is there such big differences? I mean, overall, if things under that argument work, Ed, then the realistic cost should still work in the equations. It should still come through as being a good idea to build out a certain amount of this technology. Now, back to the small modular reactors point, investing in innovation and letting technologies prove out, I think there is a strong argument in the evidence base for investing in a lot of different things. And we see that play out in this infrastructure bill, investing in a lot of different things because we don't have crystal balls and perfect foresight. And we don't also, you know, have all the same beliefs and priorities, you know, as individuals in our communities and our regions. And so investing in a lot of different technologies that can play these different roles is very important because it hedges our bets. It decreases the risk of the overall transition, and risk being that low reliability and or high costs, both of which don't work. So we need to hedge those risks.
Yeah, Amy, so I want to bring the discussion back then to the specifics of the infrastructure bill. As Melissa was saying, it's making bets on a few technologies, three in particular: nuclear, we've been talking about, hydrogen, and carbon capture. Do you think that's the right approach? I mean, are these the three most important technologies for governments to be backing? And do you think it's right then to be, as Melissa was saying, sort of hedging the bets in terms of where taxpayers' dollars are going for innovation and supporting a range of different options to see what works?
You know, I like to quote the National Academy, you know, did a study with all kinds of scientists from around the country. And one of the things they pointed out is that you really want to fund what we call cross-cutting technologies. So new materials, digital advances, and automation. So you want to be funding innovation in areas that would help nuclear, that would help hydrogen, that would help CCS. And you know, unfortunately, that's not the way the American political system works. You know, people go to the Hill with their lobbyists, and, you know, there's some person out there with a technology and they want to try to stick it into the infrastructure bill. And some of these more scientifically astute, you know, we're going to invest in nanotechnology applications for energy or something like that, you know, falls by the wayside. But in fairness to those who put together this bill, there is some evidence that people thought about that, because of course you have the emphasis on recycling and battery manufacturing. That was an important allocation of $3 billion, and smart grid is another important investment we need to be making. So, and new funds for transit, because we're not going to get anywhere in reducing the use of oil until we have alternative ways of getting around, other than the automobile that runs on gasoline.
So, Melissa, what do you think? Does this bill make sense as an energy innovation bill?
So my first comment is about the actual investment innovation. I mean, at the Center on Global Energy Policy, we put out last year a report called Energizing America, which was about outlining a roadmap effectively for a innovation mission out of the federal government. And a lot of the things that we said, when we look at the analysis, when we look at the numbers, you know, we would flag for increasing budget investments were things like carbon dioxide removal, were things like the tools that are going to help us decarbonize industry, of which hydrogen is one very interesting tool that potentially has applications across the whole energy system. So a lot of the things that we see in here, you know, these are important technologies, and they're not the usual suspects, perhaps. And they're the ones that, you know, are tough. And I'll say one of the criticisms that you can read about when it comes to former stimulus bills and investments made in the U.S. federal government is that maybe we weren't ambitious enough. And there's a really interesting discussion to be had about the role of government and how far they should push their investments. So is being in the black good? Probably. Is being really far in the black because you maybe made pretty conservative investments? Is that really the role of government? Or actually, would that portfolio be better suited somewhere in private industry where we could get the money behind it? At the end of the day, we need so much money behind the energy transition that it's important to think about the role of different funds when they come from public and private organizations.
So, Melissa, you just mentioned carbon removal, which brings me to the last thing I want to talk about this week, which is negative emissions. Technologies that can actually capture carbon dioxide directly from the atmosphere and store it for the long term. If those technologies work, they're kind of the get-out-of-jail-free card for the climate. I mean, obviously not actually free, because it's probably still very expensive, but if they worked, it would allow us to carry on using fossil fuels for all the things we want to use fossil fuels for. And as we've been saying, there are quite a lot of uses where it's very hard to find alternatives to fossil fuels. We could keep doing that and still achieve our goals for emissions by having substantial negative emissions, taking carbon dioxide out of the air. Now, the Biden administration has been trying to make progress on this, and earlier this month, Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, launched another one of what she's calling her Earth Shots. These are ambitious goals intended to stimulate innovation. They're like a moonshot, but meant to directly affect what happens to us here on Earth. And the latest one is for negative emissions. The technologies do exist today. There's a few prototypes. You probably read about them. We talked about one a few months ago here on the Energy Gang. So it's not completely new technology. It does exist, but only on a very small scale. And the costs at the moment seem to be very, very high. What the US Department of Energy wants is technologies that will capture gigatons of carbon dioxide, large volumes of carbon dioxide, really enough to make a material difference to the climate at a cost of less than $100 a ton. If that technology could be found, could be made to work at that scale, at that cost, could be really significant, I think, could be an absolute game changer for the climate debate. Melissa, what do you think? I mean, how important do you think these negative emissions technologies are going to be? And I guess, how confident would you be that this Earthshot gigaton scale carbon removal at less than $100 a ton, is that possible? Is that a goal for that technology that's achievable?
When I think about carbon dioxide removal, I think about it perhaps less as a get-out-of-jail-free card and more as a safety net, and building a few strategically placed safety nets to get those, you know, last bits of emissions that are just difficult to eliminate in the first point. So you need to figure out how to, you know, pull the equivalent amount of emissions out of the air in a verifiable, traceable way. That's really good. That's actually perhaps not that expensive if we can get it down to this $100 per ton. I think I was looking back at some of the numbers we were quoting just in the past couple of years, and I found the one from Climeworks that said that its costs are around $500 to $600 per ton. This is a Swiss direct air capture company. So $500 to $600 now. Getting it down to $100, that's certainly ambitious. So, but building those safety nets, you build a few of them, Okay, overall, in the cost of your entire system, not that expensive. If you tried to cover the world in safety nets, that's a really expensive and difficult proposition and comes with a lot of trade-offs. So what I'll say is, around the future of negative emissions technologies, I know that in the next few months here, before the next COP, we're going to see a series of scenario analysis coming out of some big organizations talking about, okay, what is the worst case scenario of reaching net zero? And the worst case scenario is we do it all with carbon dioxide removal, direct air capture, pulling it out of the air, because that's the most expensive path to go forward. But it gives us a baseline of, if you want to reach net zero, how far do you use direct air capture? And I'm going to go to another way to phrase this, which is like recycling. What is it? Reduce, reuse, recycle. So first thing is figure out where we can be more efficient. Second thing is figure out where we can actually replace emissions producing systems with zero emission systems. But then when you get to the end, you're talking about net zero, not 80% of the way there, not 90%, net zero. Thinking about where it may make sense to include some of these systems to actually pull carbon dioxide out of the air, because the damages of not mitigating those tons, not pulling them out of the system, is worse than the $100 or more cost that we're looking at. So I think it's good that we're focusing in on it. You also could take it as a sign of how serious the situation we're in is right now when it comes to mitigating climate change, because we've waited a long time to really get started.
So Amy, you've also been looking at these negative emissions technologies. What's your view? Can they be made to work?
I'll tell you my concern about it. My concern is we keep trying to excuse ourselves, using the same products, living the same way. And then we're hoping some scientist is going to come out with some technology that's going to mean that we don't have to change anything. And, you know, that's really my problem with it. I think some of these technologies will be successful, but I always worry about scale, like how many, you know, tons of carbon do I have to mineralize and bury? Like, you know, is there space in the world to bury all of that? Like, I really need people to come up with technologies. That's why I wrote this book on digital. I need people to come up with technologies where I can live my daily life and there's technologies that are going to make me able to do that in a decarbonized way, right? So I met a young entrepreneur out in California a few weeks ago that's starting a company that actually brings solar and software and batteries for 5G. So that it can be carbon free, right? So I think we need to be thinking about systems where there's something we want to do and we're thinking about how to do it with minimal waste and minimal carbon. Because, you know, this fantasy that we're just going to, you know, some scientist is going to create a doohickey and they're going to like pull, you know, carbon out of the air and we're just going to bury it somewhere. Like, think about how many tons of carbon we're talking about. Right? So, you know, should we be trying? Absolutely. Maybe in trying to do that, we'll come up with a better way of doing it. I'm all for, you know, coming up with different kinds of solutions. I've always been a person who worries deeply about biofuel solutions, right? It's one thing, we need to clean up landfills. And I worked on that. I worked on that in California. There's some really good technologies one can use to not have the methane just go up into the sky from the landfill. But of course, the better thing is to not have a landfill. And so we need technologies that do that. And, you know, one time I was in a dialogue with someone and they said to me, you know, Amy, you know, you'd be like really well positioned to help us think through the end of oil. And, you know, where we all would like that, you know, and I thought, well, that almost sounds like, you know, science fiction-esque. And I said to them, listen, as an intellectual exercise, imagining the end state world where we use no oil and then working backwards what we'd have to do for containers, for, you know, everything we do would be a good exercise, because we need to be thinking about the innovation of how we're going to get there and eliminate this from, you know, daily life.
Yeah, I've got to say, I really hate those ideas about geoengineering, throwing stuff into the atmosphere and so on. But the idea that we understand the climate well enough that we could just set the temperature precisely right to exactly the level that we wanted to be at just doesn't seem realistic to me. I guess at least negative emissions, we are doing something which is counterbalancing, offsetting the positive emissions that we're creating through our activities every day. So kind of see more of a case for that. And I think deep down, I'd really like it to be that magic wand, the doohickey that the scientist brings along that says, don't worry, you don't need to worry about any of this. It's all going to be solved. This is the thing which is going to fix it for us.
I don't like to hear these tech guys, you know. I spend a lot of time with the tech crowd writing this book. And I don't like the idea that they think they're going to plan a space program where they're not going to have to look for minerals here on Earth because they're going to like claim these minerals up in space, right? Believe it or not, people are doing that. And then the second thing is this idea that we're going to like colonize some other planet. Like we have this one amazing planet and, you know, we need to be organizing ourselves to think about how to sustain it. And I'm very big on, you know, markets for natural solutions. We have all kinds of carbon sinks that we're destroying every day. And we know what they are. That was at least one thing that came out of Glasgow, that there was much more emphasis on these natural solutions. And also, you know, the technology by which, you know, these new companies like this company Planet, where they claim they're going to have these tiny little satellites and they're going to be able to follow individual logging trucks as they go into the Amazon. So, you know, once we have a whole verification system, we can track schools of fish. We can track the fate of mangroves. We can track forestry. You know, then we can start to make real progress on making sure that we're optimizing and protecting, you know, what's left and maybe expanding it again so that we can restore the planet that we need to live.
An excellent note to end on. And finally, we have this tradition on the Energy Gang called the free electron, where each of us brings in something that we've seen during the week that we think is particularly interesting. Could be a little bit quirky, a bit offbeat, maybe something that's made us laugh during the week, but certainly something we found interesting. Melissa, what's yours?
So I've got two free electrons this week. The first one is I actually discovered a podcast episode called How Gender Equality Could Save the Planet. And during COP, I was following a lot of these threads around women and the impacts of climate change on women and children. And I just like this quote from it. Even as women are more likely to be impacted by climate change, we are less likely to be at the decision-making table about solutions. And the episode really went into, and is on the podcast, A Matter of Degrees, but it really went into the research and the evidence and kind of what we know about representation of women in these, at these tables, but also how climate change impacts the same groups that aren't represented at the table. So I just found it a really fascinating episode, my favorite one from that podcast so far. So I just wanted to flag that one. The second one is actually one that brought a smile to my face when I saw an email from Jigar Shah, who we know from the show, popped into my inbox talking about this announcement from Sunrun and Span talking about their system to accelerate whole home electrification. And so it's really about this discussion for me. Like last week, I flagged in my free electron, okay, what happens when you build solar and you can't connect it to the grid? And you end up with a $30,000 brick. Well, this one is saying, what can we actually do in our homes right now with technology that we have available to us to accelerate whole home electrification? Think about storage and reliability and integrating all these different technologies. So it's really, you know, the mix of things that we can put into our homes. And I found the article really interesting and I'm now down a rabbit hole about how do we think about home electrification systems. So those are my two for the week.
Oh, that's great. Good to hear Jigar Shah still listening. Excellent. Amy, what's yours?
Well, you know, I come to climate change in a very honest way because I've lived in multiple locations where I was a climate evacuee, floods in Houston, fires in California, hurricanes in New England, flooding in the New York subway system. So you can imagine how pleased I was when I met the folks from Urban Footprint, a new technology platform company that looks at geospatial data and combines it with what's happening to human beings on the ground and doesn't focus just on property value and property restoration. So Urban Footprint helps organizations like utilities figure out where would be the most vulnerable people to a heat wave so that they might be able to prioritize their infrastructure expansion or upgrades on a people basis and not on a machinery or infrastructure basis. And to me, that's a very powerful tool for government and powerful tool for society. So to me, it seemed like a really exciting technology that pushes the ball forward on what we can do with geospatial analysis.
You're right, that does sound absolutely fascinating. Really interesting to hear about technology being applied in those kind of creative ways to these very significant problems. So my one is a bit frivolous. I'm just getting very excited about these new fancy EVs that companies are starting to talk about. So just this year, for the first time in 10 years, nearly 11 years, we acquired a car. We've been living in New York and I've managed to do without a car for the past 10 years, which has been great. I've loved it. But unfortunately, just for various reasons, we've now had to have one. But we've leased it. So we've got a lease and it's whatever, 3 years time or so, that'll be up. It's a conventional gasoline car. Again, for various reasons, it's difficult for us to have an EV, which I would have liked to do, was not able to do. But the new kind of EVs that are now coming on the market just look very exciting and have made me think next time around, we should definitely get an EV and just work out some way we are going to be able to find somewhere to charge it, which is tricky for us, as I say, at the moment. There's this thing I was looking at, the Hyundai one, which is just amazing. This kind of retro style of the Hyundai Grandeur Heritage EV concept car, which basically looks like a sort of a Cadillac or a Lincoln Continental or something from the 70s. Just very, very kind of stylish. It looks like the kind of car that people used to drive in The Godfather, but it's an EV. Is really nice. And then there's a fantastic one from Ford as well. Ford have been talking about recently their Illuminator concept truck, F-100, which is looks like something again from the sort of the 50s or the 60s. Looks like the kind of thing that James Dean might have driven around in one of his movies. Very kind of appealing designs, really interesting, kind of great engaging ways, I think, to get people looking at EVs, thinking about EVs in new ways. If you're not kind of necessarily sold just merely on the fact of it being an EV, these fun and interesting designs, I think, are a great way to get people thinking about EVs in a new way. They've certainly done that for me. So these are concept cars. They're not necessarily on the market. The way of concept cars usually is they never do make it to the market. So I may be disappointed in wanting to buy one of these, but I do very badly want to buy one of these as soon as I can. So this is definitely something I'm going to be looking out for and keeping my fingers crossed that some of them do actually become available on the market.
You're not alone. Some of them look really cool. I got to say, when I can find one that can pull our trailer when we're traveling around the country, I'm on the list that moment because they look really, really neat.
So that is all from the Energy Gang for this week. Thank you very much, Melissa.
Thanks, Ed. And Amy, Ed, it's been great to be here with y'all today.
Thank you, Amy, very much for joining us as well.
Been really a pleasure.
And many thanks to all of you for listening. Please do let us know what you think. Give us your comments, suggestions, ideas for subjects that we ought to be covering. We're on Twitter at The Energy Gang, and I'm at Ed_Crooks. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on what's next for the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.